M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Judge Reyes, I think you're on mute.
Can you hear me now? Okay. My cursor hovered over it and shut it off. Thank you. Good morning. Today is Thursday, July 23rd, 2020. We have three cases set for oral argument today. This is our third case. We are holding them virtually via WebEx using a new platform. And we will be still following the regular procedures in terms of having 15 minutes for appellant, 15 minutes for respondent, and then 5 minutes again for appellant on rebuttal, if you so choose. I'd like to make sure that we can hear both parties. Counsel for respondent, if you could just say something, make sure that we can hear you. We can see you fine.
Yes, good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Loud and clear. Sounds good. Counsel for appellant?
Good morning, Your Honor. Jeffrey Sheridan here.
Okay, good. We can hear you as well. Hopefully, we won't have any issues, but if we do, we will certainly make sure we make appropriate accommodations if something arises. Certainly, feel free to go on mute when you're not speaking. If you hover over the panel, it's the far left button. Then, of course, once you do start speaking, make sure that you push the button so you can be heard, just like I had to do. We will feel free to do any hand signals or anything, though, if for some reason you can't hear any of us or you can't hear opposing counsel. So with that, unless there are any other questions, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jeffrey Sheridan. I am the attorney for the appellant in this case. His name is Kenny Harold. This matter is before the court on a direct appeal from a judgment of conviction for a case involving a fourth degree misdemeanor driving while impaired and driving with an alcohol concentration greater than 0.08. There are three issues that I have raised in my brief for your consideration. Time constraints being what they are, it is my intention to focus my arguments this morning on the first two issues. That does not mean that I have abandoned the third issue, and I'm happy to obviously address any questions the court may have with regard to the third issue as well. The first issue that I would like to address, and address probably briefly, is the question having to do with whether the district court erred in refusing to suppress the evidence in this case in the form of field sobriety tests. The state has argued
Mr. Sheridan, can I'd like to ask you to talk about the expert issue instead first, because I think that is really the crux of the case. And I want to focus on Mr. Burr's proffer. So Mr. Burr, as I read his proffer, the one that occurred in the middle of trial, he says that he would testify about methods and processes for conducting a breath test, right?
Correct.
Okay. But he also says in his proffer that he would not be testifying about a malfunction or test results or the accuracy of the results themselves. Is that right?
Well, the accuracy of the results was always in question, Your Honor, and that was the gist of everything we were raising, is whether this machine as configured is capable of producing accurate and reliable results.
Well, but we do have information about the standard of deviation of it being approximately 0.02, and appellant's blood alcohol level had registered at 0.11. So even given that margin of error, it still is over the legal limit. So is that even an issue in this case?
Your Honor, I do believe it is an issue. And the again, in the absence of expert testimony, what the state presented in this case is that Mr. Harold blew into a tube and a piece of paper came out of the machine on the other end in the printer. And everything in between is a mystery. Somehow the district court concluded that expert testimony to discuss what happens between the blowing and the printing is somehow irrelevant to the case. So the idea that we as humans just intuitively know that blowing into machinery will produce a criminal accusation out of the other end without us having to worry our pretty little heads about what happens between the blowing and the printing is just incorrect.
But counsel, I think what the district court, I mean, I think there's a lot of things within the district court's ultimate findings that are questionable, but the piece of it that I want to focus on is that the district court was indicating that the testimony about methodology and processes, as kiddy-wampus as they may be, without some testimony tying the methodology or processes or deficiencies in those processes to the actual result, the testimony is ultimately not helpful to the fact finder. Well, so why is that not within the district court's discretion to make that determination based on this record?
Because the question presented in with regard to all of this has to do with the state's decision to take a machine that was approved by the manufacturer in a particular configuration and deconfigure it, come up with their own methodology of trying to determine a person's alcohol concentration, dismissing the manufacturer's process in producing the instrument. And our position throughout is that once you did that, once the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension did that, by eliminating the scientific safeguards that were put in by the manufacturer to help determine whether a person's alcohol was being measured or whether a person's alcohol plus other things was being measured by the machine. So the data that we presented showed that the fuel cell device that was included in this machine was included there for the specific purpose of keeping non-alcohol substances, in this case, they're referred to as interfering chemicals, from adding to the alcohol result. So when you say, Judge, that the machine has this standard deviation, which is perfectly fine, if all we're measuring is alcohol, our concern, what we're trying to raise in front of the jury, is that because the state has disabled the machine in this particular way, there is no way for us to know whether this machine is in fact only measuring alcohol or measuring alcohol plus.
But is there any allegation in this case, under these facts, that there were any other substances that appellant had ingested?
Judge, had the witness been permitted to testify, he would have told us that the problem is because the state disabled the machine, there is absolutely no way for us to now know whether it was measuring alcohol alone or measuring alcohol plus.
But those facts are not before us in this case.
Well, because the witness was not permitted to testify. It is the...
But he had a proffer. You had the ability to put that in front on the record, though.
Well, and that was his testimony, that this machine, as configured, is not capable of producing accurate and reliable test results. That was
that?
The
proper...
But that's only if there is potentially, if there's alcohol and other substances that could interfere with the testing, when you've got two ways of testing with the machine and one way of testing has been shut down.
Right, but the part of the machine that was shut down was the part that would separate out alcohol from non-alcohol substances.
Right, but I'm struggling with the relevance of that. If that isn't part of the proffer, if that's not at issue in this particular case, we're getting into hypothetical. What if he had consumed something else in addition to alcohol?
Judge, these are not things that are consumed. These are things that have a particular molecular makeup that exists in the world and exists in human bodies. It is the thing that the fuel cell was designed by the state's own website admission that we offered. They are chemicals that exist in the world that mock or mimic alcohol molecules.
Mr. Sheridan?
Measured as alcohol molecules.
Let me jump in. I think I see the disconnect between your argument and the questions, and I just want to see if I can frame it up. Your position is that there is no need to have an offer of proof that your client had consumed or was near some other substance, because the machine itself might detect things that your client is not necessarily aware of in your client's body. Is that your position?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that ultimately it is the state's burden to prove that what got measured in Mr. Harold was alcohol and only alcohol. And because the state had disabled the device in a way that we can now not ever know whether non-alcohol related or non-alcohol substances are being added to the alcohol result, that creates at a minimum reasonable doubt if somebody was allowed to tell the jurors about that.
So that is the piece actually that I think is, from my read of the proffer, that's missing. So I agree that the proffer sets forth that there's some deficiency that your expert has identified in the process and the methodology. The deficiency is as you have described, but that there's nothing that ties that deficiency to the ultimate result that's kicked out of the machine in this particular case. So again, my question is, why is that not within the district court's discretion to say the ultimate opinion would not be helpful to the fact finder because your expert's ultimately not testifying that the result that's kicked out is wrong?
Well, because we have no way of knowing whether the result was right or wrong. That it's a circular argument. We end up, you say, well, there's no way, there's no evidence. We can't point to something to say, this was acetone, this was toluene, this was something else that could measure as alcohol on an infrared only testing device. So because you can't point to that, therefore your testimony is irrelevant. But the fact is that the very thing that would have told us whether any of those interfering substances were present and were being added to Mr. Harold's alcohol result, that's the thing that the state disabled, the thing that would provide us with the very evidence you're telling us we had to prove before we had a chance to prove that the machine didn't measure it. That is the circular argument, the circle that we got placed into by the district court in this case.
In other words, I think what you're suggesting is that your client was prohibited from offering evidence of a reasonable doubt because your client was prohibited from, well, because the test has been changed, the apparatus has been changed so that the safeguard that would allow for sort of the check on the system is no longer operable. Is that what you're suggesting the argument would have been had you been able to present that evidence to the jury?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And again, as it was left, it was, he blew into the machine, or at least at the time the state rested, he blew into the machine and a piece of paper came out that had a damaging number on it. And again, don't worry your pretty little heads about what happens in between the blow and the printing. And that is the evidence that this witness could ultimately have brought to the conversation, and in doing so, established for that jury why it is so vitally important that on a dual technology machine, both technologies be functioning, because the very existence of that second technology was there to prevent the exact thing that we were arguing about in this case, the addition of non-alcohol to the alcohol result. And therefore, the standard deviation is irrelevant. It would be relevant if we knew the only thing we were testing was alcohol. Our point is we have no idea, given what the state did to this machine, whether in fact that's all that's being measured. And that's what we were permitted, we should have been permitted to talk about in front of the jury, because this is not intuitive. Okay, this is not the kind of thing that all all humans understand. That, of course, if you blow into the machinery, it's going to produce a criminal accusation at the other end. That is not an intuitive thing. That is the essence of why we have expert testimony, why we permit it in the first place, is because it is assistive to the trier of fact.
With the small amount of time you have left, I'd like you to address the first issue. I'm trying to get a sense of what you believe is being searched when an officer asks an individual to perform a walk and turn test or a one-leg stand test. How is that a search?
The officer himself in this case, if you look through the cross-examination and the evidentiary hearing, said that he was conducting these tests for the purpose of searching my client's person for evidence in the form of clues of impairment, that he was searching my client's person for evidence of potential.
Despite what the officer said, from a legal and conceptual standpoint, how is an officer observing conduct a search? What is the thing being searched? We can know that if an officer goes through a person's computer, the computer is being searched. We can know if he goes through a person's desk that the desk drawers are being opened and the desk drawers are being searched. What is being searched when the officer asks an individual to perform standard field sobriety tests, the physical tests I'm referring to, not the PBT?
And if it was merely an asking in a polite conversation where the other person in this information differential knew they had no obligation to do it, that might be a valid point. But what we have is an armed, uniformed, badged police officer.
No, I understand your point that it's forced. My question though is, what's being searched? What is the thing? In a search, we generally think of an intrusion of some type into a space in which there's privacy.
The body is what is being searched. The officer himself testified that none of these observations that he made that ultimately became his testimony in this case, that none of those observations are visible to the naked eye unless he directs the person to behave in a particular way, and then he can make these observations of clues of impairment that have been apparently vetted in a way that they become credible evidence.
No, I understand that. I guess it's the concept of what is a quote search, the lack of intrusion. This is an officer asking an individual to do something that allows the officer to make observations of what's on the outside with the performance of certain maneuvers.
None of which would be visible to his naked eye in plain view, in Fourth Amendment speak, none of which would be available to him unless he compelled the person or cajoled or whatever, got the person to perform these particular physical and mental exercises.
Let me give you an example, if I may. You're over your time, but if I can, I'll ask Presiding Judge Reyes if I may inquire.
Yes, sir.
Just briefly. Okay, so in a lineup situation, individuals are standing in the lineup. A bank has been robbed. The tellers have told the police that the robber said, "Give me your money or else." And during the lineup, is it your view that an officer needs reasonable suspicion or some level of constitutional justification to tell everyone in the lineup to utter that line, to say audibly what it is that the teller heard? You believe that's a search?
I do, and I believe that in order to compel that, the case law would suggest you need a prior court order or the consent of the people who are involved in the. So those are the things that I made reference to in a footnote about voice exemplars and writing samples and all of those things that all require a prior court order.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Bernstein, and I represent the respondent to the state of Minnesota in this case. I will start addressing the second issue as well with respect to the expert. The district court did not abuse its discretion when it precluded Thomas Burr from testifying as an expert witness. And the starting point of the court's analysis should be whether or not Mr. Burr was even an expert. And the answer to that question pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Evidence 702 is no.
This is what, I'm troubled a bit by that. I mean, it seems as if the effort was made by the defendant once it was determined that the expert was not really a sufficiently qualified expert, that both the state and, well, the state opposed those steps, it seemed to me, that would have allowed the defendant to have the expert qualify as an expert. For the life of me, I just don't understand why it is, if a defendant says, I would like to buy a machine so I can know what happens on the inside of the machine, why the state would oppose, and why the district court would allow the state, would validate the state's opposition to allow a defendant to know what's happening inside that machine. Can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. And I want to make sure this issue is characterized properly. The state did not oppose the defense purchasing an instrument for use. The defense filed a motion compelling the state, pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 902, to assist the defense in purchasing this instrument. The state argued that that was not the state's obligation under Rule of Evidence, Rule of Criminal Procedure 902, and that the defense was welcome to purchase an instrument, but the state was not compelled to assist.
Right, and so then we have the request made to the company itself, which says, sorry, we got copyright issues, you can't have it. I will tell you, just in the interest of full disclosure, back when all this drama was going on about the source code, I had the same concern. If, you know, the state gets to stand, but back then it was the state, not the company, standing behind this copyright protection, this or trade secrets or whatever it was, that would stop defendants from knowing what happens inside that machine. And I've got to tell you, if you had a machine that said pedophile at the other end, and a person was accused of sex abuse of a child, and the jury gets to find out, well, you know, there was this machine, we asked the defendant to touch it, and by golly, there's a document that says essentially he's guilty, and you can rely upon that, but you're not going to give the defendant absolutely complete access to know what's going on inside that machine. I am struggling with the due process concerns about it, and to me, you know, I don't understand why the state wouldn't cooperate with the defendant in this case to assist the defendant to get whatever data is necessary for the full defense.
Your Honor, the state felt that this went beyond its discovery obligations. With that said, I believe Mr. Sheridan was able to purchase an intoxilizer, the previous version of the instrument, and he indicated that he may be able to purchase the Data Master, but he thought it would help for the state to assist. The state wasn't sure, frankly, how it would be able to assist, but this was a defense request that went beyond the discovery and Brady obligations.
Well, but doesn't the state work with the manufacturer in order to get these machines and provide for the purchase of them and provide for the documentation as to how to operate it, how it functions, how to replace parts? I share Judge Ross's concern. I used to practice intellectual property law. I don't see how there are any issues with respect to copyrights or trade secrets. That's information that is freely provided by the manufacturer. Furthermore, I take issue with the defense expert not being qualified as an expert. He went through the same training that people who actually use a machine go through. So I'm struggling as to why he wouldn't be qualified as an expert. It seems the bar is so high that only somebody who actually has run the machine as an employee of the BCA would qualify. That doesn't seem to be, that's not the appropriate standard here.
Your Honor, with respect, comparing Mr. Burr's qualifications to the BCA's qualifications requires evidence that's outside of this record. The record does not reflect the training that the BCA personnel has obtained. The record does not reflect the training that certified operators have obtained specifically. What the record does reflect is Mr. Burr's curriculum vitae and his lack of qualifications. It deeply troubles the state that Mr. Burr testified in voir dire that he was not certified to operate the intoxilizer. And yet, not only did he operate the intoxilizer, he testified in cases and he characterized himself as an expert witness testifier as opposed to a certified operator.
This isn't an intoxilizer case.
That's correct, but it does call into question Mr. Burr's qualifications under Rule 702. With respect specifically—
But that's not why the district court excluded him and said he wasn't qualified. The district court erected a bunch of hurdles that no one other than the state could ever satisfy. The district court says that the person has to be there at the time of the stop, the person has to be there at the time of testing, the person has to examine the exact machine that's used to conduct the testing, and the person has to conduct testing on the DMT itself. And using those standards, which I don't know, I mean, they were advocated by the state as appropriate standards, no one could ever qualify as an expert witness other than the state's witness from the BCA. So how's that fair?
The district court did not require all of those things, but the district court was looking for something that would establish that the opinion that Mr. Burr wanted to testify about was somehow relevant and was not more prejudicial than probative.
Well, I didn't understand how the district court's criteria was relevant. Why does it matter if the issue is how a machine performs generally at all times? Why does it matter whether he observed the test in this case? Why does it matter whether he tested this machine? If everyone acknowledges that there is a double check mechanism that was disabled, that itself has some effect on the process, who cares? What is the basis for the district court having any of those criteria?
Well, I have a two-part answer to that question.
And by the way, the district court apparently didn't come up with those on its own. The district court was moved that way by the state's position. So what's the state's justification for leading the district court to believe that these things were relevant when the defense was pretty clear that it was the focus of how the machine operates in the abstract?
Sure. I have two answers to that question, Your Honor. First, the decision to turn the fuel cell off was made by the BCA. The BCA conducted a validation study to establish that the results are accurate with the fuel cell turned off versus turned on. Mr. Burr wanted to testify about the accuracy of the data master with the fuel cell turned off. Mr. Burr himself had not conducted any studies, had not published any articles, and did not have a valid basis to testify that the data master was somehow inaccurate or produced inaccurate results with the fuel cell turned off.
And here we have the circle, because he wasn't allowed access to the information to perform those tests. And he's told that there's copyright restrictions, and the state is, I mean, with all due respect, when I look at the record, I don't see the state as saying, like, I remember the intoxilizer cases where the state would say, you know what? We've got these contracts, we're stuck with them, otherwise we would help. In this case, it seems as if the state is there making sure that there are extra hurdles for the defendant and not just saying, well, you know, it's the company. And by the way, I have a problem with the state contracting with a company and then having allowing the company to say, we're not going to provide you the information because we're not required to, even though it's clear arm in arm between the company and the state as to both the machine and the processing.
Well, and Your Honor, I don't remember offhand to what extent this is in the record, but when the state first purchased the data master, the source code was public information. The intellectual property was publicly available. The original manufacturer sold the data master to another manufacturer, which then privatized that intellectual property and would not disclose it. The state was not a party to that sale.
Understood.
Well, if it's out in the public, it's not trade secret anymore.
I understand, Your Honor.
That source code is freely available, so that's not an issue. And even if it was an issue, even if it had not become public, you can still put a protective order in place to protect the IP rights of the manufacturer. But I have a question in terms of Mr. Sheridan referred basically to a black box. You know, you put something in and then it spits out information. But right now there's a black box there, and that black box is something that had been switched out. The original testing machine used only infrared technology. The subsequent one had dual technology, infrared technology and fuel cell, and it was supposedly purchased
to be an improvement. You've got now a double check in essence. But then the BCA shuts off the fuel cell. So in essence, you're back to square one. Why isn't a party allowed to test that machine to determine whether or not it truly is accurate enough, accurate and functions the way the company claims it does? Why should we just go on blind faith that, oh, they say it's the standard deviation is only the delta number is only 0.02? Why shouldn't a party be allowed to test that and to verify that it does in fact function the way it is claimed?
Your Honor, a party certainly can. As a matter of fact, the record was clear in this case that the data master used to test appellant was held at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and available for someone to come and test and to examine. So that certainly is available if a party chooses to go down that road.
So you're telling me that in Mr. Sheridan's next case, when he says, I want to come down with my expert to take a look at that data master, you're not going to stand in his way?
Your Honor, the state did not stand in his way in this case. The BCA held the data master and indicated that it was available for examination pursuant to BCA standards.
What do you mean?
Those standards?
Standards?
Your Honor, I don't know that that information is in the record, but I know the BCA has policies in terms of how and when a data master can be examined.
And can a person examining the data master or its reliability turn on the apparatus that the BCA has turned off?
Your Honor, that would be a question for the BCA. I'm not sure of that answer. But Your Honor,
So Mr. Sheridan could come in on the next case, ask to test it. I hate to get into the details, but could he come in and actually test it, have it control the way that the people who actually use the test machine, the data master test machine, to have controls, to have blinds, to go through all of the procedures that are done to confirm that it does actually work as intended, that it actually does measure accurately alcohol, and more importantly, that if there aren't any interference, that those won't be read by the infrared technology, which is very limited, that it won't read other substances as being alcohol when in fact they are not alcohol, whether it's ketones, whether it's ketals, whether it's amphetamines, any other substance that could potentially be picked up as a false positive.
Your Honor, I don't know a reason why the defense would not be able to do that. Those arrangements can be made by through the BCA. And I want to emphasize in this case, the state did not stand in the way of having that examination done. The state's position was that under Rule 902 and Brady case law, the state was not obligated to assist the defense in setting that up. With that said, the defense could have made arrangements. And as a matter of fact, the record is clear that Mr. Byrd did obtain some materials from the BCA. And so that is available to the defense.
I'm curious why it would not have been sufficient in your mind for the defense simply to be able to cross-examine Mr. Byrd as opposed to disqualifying him altogether, since you've argued in a few different ways that his testimony could be undermined.
Well, again, Your Honor, the district court's ruling was based on multiple bases. One was Rule 702, that he was not an expert, but also based on Rules 402 and 403. And the state specifically cited to the Wolf case, which mentioned Mr. Byrd by name, and that case stands for the proposition that an expert cannot testify about possible theories or speculation. And that's what the state argued in this case, was that the entirety of Mr. Byrd's proffered testimony was based upon speculation, possible theories, not facts based in evidence.
When you say speculation, there is no speculation, is there? That the data master built into the machine an internal testing process that was disabled by the BCA, and that could have some consequence on the reliability of the results. Why is that speculation?
And Your Honor, I see my time is up, but if I may answer to that question.
Yes, you may.
Your Honor, in this case, all the evidence presented by the state established that there were no interference present, that all precautionary steps were taken to ensure that everything the data master measured was alcohol. The district court asked the defense
You didn't go through all the steps because the BCA disabled one of those steps that would have given the answer.
And Your Honor, it's important to note that this instrument is called the DMT-G with fuel cell option. So the manufacturer itself advertises that having the fuel cell on and off is an option. They do guarantee that the instrument is accurate even with the fuel cell turned off. The BCA conducted the validation study, which Ms. Kierzik testified about. And I do want to emphasize, Ms. Kierzik was a witness called by the defense. When the district court precluded Mr. Burr from testifying, the district court said that the defense could call another expert with sufficient foundation. Any expert the defense wanted, the defense chose to call Ms. Kierzik.
The state says, well, here's all you got. You got to choose someone on our team. Imagine that. It's like, well, you know, the Vikings quarterback went down, but the Packers say, well, you know, you could use one of our backup quarterbacks. That should be sufficient. And when we're playing the Packers, how does that work? That seems like what happened here. I'll just tell you that this smells really bad. That's just my impression.
And I see that my time is up, Your Honors. Thank you.
Judge Ross, Judge Frisch, any additional questions? Okay, thank you both. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Sheridan, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. This whole question, and if you ever want to scare a district court judge, start talking about them the speculation, right? That's the word that everybody is afraid of, is this speculation. So counsel says, well, we're speculating that this that there was a substance in his body other than alcohol that could register as alcohol on this device. The real speculation, though, is that this mechanism that was built in to ensure that non-alcohol substances don't get added to an alcohol concentration was disabled. We're acknowledging that. But we're asking you to speculate that despite the fact that we disabled that it still somehow miraculously came up with the correct result anyway.
But Mr. Sheridan, you know, notwithstanding the parade of horribles that we sort of discussed already with Mr. Bernstein, I'm really focused on the impact of the questionable methodology on the result. And when the district court does say that the proposed testimony is speculative, it has a possibility of confusing the jury, its prejudicial nature outweighs its probative value, and ultimately concludes that all of the testimony about a potentially inferior or incorrect methodology without some tie to the actual result, that's what I think is missing from the proffer, and I'm really focused on the proffer.
Okay, but we're chicken and egging this. I mean, first of all, understand we have a black box. Everybody acknowledges that somebody should know something between the blow and the printout, right? And the state offered none of that. Okay, our goal was to say, hey, look, folks, I realize the government is telling you that blowing and pieces of paper are connected to each other in this innate way, and you all should understand that, hey, we're from the government and we're here to help. Okay, that's sort of their position, because they rested their case without doing anything beyond he blew here and a piece of paper came out there. All right, our goal was to bring in, first of all, an expert of over 50 years experience about what goes on in those black boxes. Nobody knows the history of the machines, the, you know, all the different machines we've used, all the different incantations or incarnations, I apologize, of black boxes, then the person we called to testify about it. And he would then expand and say, here's the problem with this black box. Okay, Mr. Bernstein is perfectly welcome at that point in time to bring in his own expert and say, hey, don't worry about what that guy's telling you over there, because we did our validation studies, we did X, we did Y, and we crossed all of our T's and dotted all of our I's. And that is a fair trial, that we both get to confront and cross-examine each other's witnesses to test who makes more sense here. And instead, the district court said, nope, the only way this is ever gonna come up in this courtroom, that this happened at all, is you're gonna have to use their team, their expert, the very person, by the way, who made the decision to disable part of a machine that she originally, in the request for proposal to companies, told the manufacturers, this is going to get you extra points, is if you can come to us with dual technology, this is going to get you extra points, because we want the bestest, darndest machine there is out there.
Mr. Sheridan, why isn't it sufficient that, why is the state's process of allowing use of the data master sufficient to qualify and or just simply to test and provide the evidence available that the disabling actually has a significant effect on the result?
Because it's not just you're talking about the offer that we could, yes, go down and look at the machine. That was what it was an offer for us to go down and look at the machine. It's not an offer to say that you may bring with you a troop of variously inebriated people, various people with certain medical conditions that we will then run them through a complete battery of validation testing.
What was you're suggesting that you would not have been able to do that?
Not at the BCA. I would have been able to do that on my own machine.
Why couldn't you have done it at the BCA if you're allowed to use their machine to bring in, just like with the intoxilizer, you bring in people at different stages of inebriation and medical conditions, and then you run them through the tests? You're suggesting you weren't allowed to do that?
That was not what was offered to me. It was, if you want to come down and look at the machine, here it is, come on down. Don't bring a screwdriver. Don't try to take it apart. Don't try to examine the machine. All of which we could have done with our own machine. Of which I offered to do. What I needed was a court order directing the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to acquire one for me, and I would have paid for it, as I did with the intoxilizer, because there is an exclusive contract for the Minnesota model of Data Master that would have precluded, it precludes me right now from buying one on the open market. I don't get to go to eBay.
And so I'm clear. You're suggesting that there was something in the process here that would have, that you know, would have prohibited you from enabling the disabled feature and testing it.
That's a software change that was made at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and deployed system-wide. I have no idea how they would have, in this particular case, undisabled that particular feature. But again, I mean, Judge, I think as you pointed out, I offered everything I possibly could to bridge whatever education gap the district court thought existed between a data master expert and my expert.
So
I was turned down at every turn.
Okay, so Mr. Sheridan, I realize we're past time, but I think these are obviously important issues that we want to clarify. And I do have a couple of questions, and if my colleagues do, I certainly will allow them the opportunity to ask further questions. I have a couple. One is, you had mentioned that the data master manufacturer has, it sounds like you said that they have an exclusive license or production agreement with the state of Minnesota, so you cannot purchase a data master that the state uses on your own?
I cannot purchase a Minnesota model data master without the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension being the entity that orders it, just as I could not purchase a Minnesota model of the Intoxilizer 5000. I could buy 5000s anywhere I wanted on eBay, but a Minnesota model I could not purchase without a direct court order. That's why we needed the court order.
Okay, and so going back to going to the BCA to do testing, it sounds like they wouldn't let you take that and do testing on your own, but you could go to their lab and could you have tested it to make sure that it actually is indeed functioning properly. So I'm assuming, just by way of background, I used to work in a lab. I have a chemistry degree. So you have standards that you use for machines. You have samples that you use to determine whether or not that particular machine is operating properly and within its standard of deviation. And if it's not, then you have to work on it. You have to fix the machine. I'm assuming that the data master works in the same way, and that technicians or scientists or engineers who are operating it test it on a daily basis, have lab notebooks where they keep all that information. Would you have been allowed to run those tests or even review the lab notebooks to confirm one way or another whether or not that either the day that it had been used on appellant or even the day that you went in to test that it is or had been operating properly?
Judge, I don't know the answer to that question. What I do know is that the machine was offered for us to come look at about 2 years after the test that was conducted on Mr. Harold. And so I'm not sure what relevance at that point that particular device, and as Judge Ross was pointing out, it's not about that particular device. It's about data masters that are running without the fuel cell operating. And that was the goal, was to get that into the hands of the person who could have conducted those studies.
Okay, so let me ask you a little bit more of an open-ended question. What testing, let's assume for the sake of argument that the district court allowed your expert to go in to test the data master using only the infrared analysis with the fuel cell turned off. What would have you been allowed to do in terms of that testing?
My understanding of what they were permitting is for us to come and look at the machine and turn it on and have somebody blow in it, was my understanding of what was being offered, not that we were being offered an opportunity to undertake our own validation studies by bringing in multiple test subjects, by bringing in chemicals at various levels to introduce to see if we could trigger a response for interfering chemicals, to the things that might produce an alcohol plus result, those sorts of things. That never struck me as what I was being offered.
Okay, thank you. Judge Ross, Judge Frisch?
Thank you.
No, thank you, thank you.
Thank you both for the additional time for us to ask questions and answer those. Obviously, this is an issue that we are looking at very, very carefully, and we appreciate the briefing and in particular the oral arguments today. Thank you both very much. We'll be issuing an order in this case in the statutory timeframe of 90 days. With that, we wish you both good health and please be safe.
You stay safe as well.
You as well. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you to both of you. Nice job.
Thank you.